Good evening and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Cubberly Theater in Palo Alto. My name is Catherine Strail. It is my pleasure to introduce Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and editor of Gourmet Today. Ruth began her culinary career as a chef and co-owner of the Swallow Restaurant in Berkeley, where she played a significant role in the culinary revolution of the 1970s. She began her food writing career with her cookbook, A Feastery, and quickly moved on to become the food writer and editor of the New West and food editor and critic for the Los Angeles Times. Known for her adventurous spirit and brazen honesty, Ruth returned to her native New York City in 1993 as the restaurant critic for the New York Times, and 6 years later became editor-in-chief of the Gourmet. The recipient of 4 James Baird Awards, Ruth has received critical acclaim for her best-selling memoirs, Tender at the Bone, Comfort Me with Apples, Garlic and Sapphires, and most recently, Not Becoming My Mother. She also serves as the executive producer of Gourmet Diary of a Foodie and the forthcoming Gourmet Appetite for Living. Our moderator for this evening is Katrina Heron, director of the Chez Panisse Foundation and former editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ruth Reichel and Katrina Heron.
Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with Ruth and all of you. I'm going to jump in and ask you, why is fresh and freshly made food, why is it important? In this world, in everyday life anyway, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that it's actually not important at all.
What evidence?
I can't speak for the people listening tonight and with us here in the audience, but I know what most of America ate today.
I think that that's precisely evidence of the fact that we need to go back to real food, to fresh food, and there are thousands of reasons for it. And one is that we now live in a world where there are actually children who, if you show them an orange, don't know that that's an orange because they think orange juice grows on trees in boxes. And I think that our connection to the earth is very important to us as human beings, and that when we lose the ability to appreciate and accept fresh food, we're losing a really vital connection to the earth. And I think that you can trace so many of the problems that we have as a society to the fact that, you know, we close our eyes to what's happening to the animals who are raised in confinement facilities. And it's easy for us to just pretend that that steak arrived in the supermarket wrapped in its piece of plastic, that it was never part of an animal. And when you raise children who don't understand the whole cycle of life, you lose a whole idea of community. That's the sort of moral, ethical reason for us to be eating fresh food. Then there are all the health reasons. I mean, there's so much evidence now that the industrialized processed food that has been inflicted on this country has turned out to be, we've been treated as guinea pigs, and the experiment is now being seen to be a failure, and what we've reaped is an epidemic of obesity. We've got a nation of people with terrible diabetes problems and all kinds of health problems that are directly relatable to this kind of, you know, fat, salt, and sugar-laden food that we've eaten.
And I think that if we look through Gourmet's history, probably there were unintended consequences to the kinds of menus and recipes and ideas that it was giving. out since its founding in 1941, but certainly this book that you're here to talk about this evening, Gourmet Today, really, I assume, reflects a lot of both the moral and the taste-oriented and the sort of civic-mindedness of what you're saying here.
I mean, this book is very much a book for the modern cook, and I ended up essentially writing this book for my son.
How old is he?
He's 20, and
his name is Nick.
His
right?
name is Nick, and he went off to college, and you know everybody knows about the freshman 15, where you know you're supposed to gain 15 pounds in your freshman year, and Nick actually lost 20 because he just said, "I can't eat this food," and.
Do we dare ask where he went to college?
He's at Wesleyan. But more than the food, he wanted the connection of, there's something about the way college food is today where food is available 24/7 and people go off to eat whenever it's convenient, and he missed meals. And he missed...
Did he miss you cooking?
I don't think he missed me cooking so much. I think he just missed the... You know, sitting down with friends and having that time to talk. And then he wanted, you know, nice fresh food. He didn't want processed food. And so in his second semester, he moved into a place where he could cook. And he started cooking. And as he started cooking, he started calling and asking me questions. And this book is about the answer to many of his questions.
So I think you said that more than half of the recipes in this book, Gourmet Today, can be made in less than half an hour. Maybe we can assume that those are the ones he's making, but that means that almost the other half then requires some devotion and some time commitment. So is this book going to serve two different audiences?
No, it's the same audience. I think that in this new food culture that we've created, we all cook in two very distinct ways. And one is recreationally, where there's nothing more appealing to people like me than to spend an entire weekend creating a meal for my friends. On the other hand, I work really hard, and I don't usually get home from work until about 7:30, and I need to get dinner on the table really quickly. And there's no reason why you can't have food that's really wonderful that you put on the table in 20 minutes. And part of what this book is about is how much help there is now out there in the supermarket, that you can get really interesting food. There's this incredible cornucopia of ethnic food out there. And there are all kinds of ways to, prepared chili pastes and... if you want to, you can get pre-chopped onions. There's nothing shameful about that if you're in a hurry.
You're condoning pre-chopped onions?
I am.
Okay, Ruth Reichel is condoning pre-chopped onions. You really do honor the vegetables in this book, though, I've noticed. And so tell us about that.
Well, the vegetable chapter is, for me, one of the most exciting things that's happened in the marketplace is the proliferation of produce. When you walk through a farmer's market and when you walk through a supermarket, suddenly you see all kinds of things that weren't there before, from the whole range of Latino vegetables, the yuca, the chiles, the tomatillos, to Asian vegetables, to, La Sonata kale, which 5 years ago nobody in America knew what it was. Now it's ubiquitous. And we decided that what we needed to do was not only give people recipes, but tell people, how do you buy this? What is it? How do you choose it? How do you store it? And what are the simplest ways? To braise it, roast it, steam it, whatever. Just so people get a familiarity with vegetables. And this was sort of, Nick joined a CSA.
Uh-huh.
And he would call me up and say, Mom, they just sent me, 2 pounds of cardoons. What's a cardoon and what do I do with it? And
I think he really was then. There was a kinship between him and many, many people across America who have really started to have an enthusiasm for the CSA box. But everybody calls each other, on the day that it arrives and says, "What is this?
What is this funny
and
thing?
What do I do with it?" Yeah. So people who have this book then will actually know what to do with the cardoons.
Yes, and what's exciting is there are old vegetables that are coming back. I mean, kohlrabi. I would guess that half of America wouldn't recognize a kohlrabi when they saw it.
Guilty.
And those who do recognize it think it probably grows underground, which it doesn't, and don't know what to do. But 50 years ago, Americans knew and recognized kohlrabi and used it.
I hardly know what to say about that.
The kohlrabi growers of America are coming after you any minute.
Tell me, what does the word gourmet mean now?
Well, that is really interesting, because when Gourmet magazine started in 1941, I think what a gourmet was a fat, rich person who was probably male. And it was this bon vivant who was sort of a snob. Today, in this wonderful food culture that we've created, a gourmet is someone who loves food. And they don't need to love fancy food, and they don't need to be rich, and they certainly don't need to be fat.
The industrialized food system and fast food was a great step forward in the domestic emancipation of women. And I'm just curious how you react to this paradox. It must come up, very often. I mean, here you are, a working woman, extraordinarily successful, and your own mother, I think you've written, was very, very plagued by the fact that she was so intelligent, never was really allowed to work. But it's questionable how many women today would be allowed to work if we were still living in a world where they had to spend most of their time in the kitchen.
Well, it depends. When you talk about the emancipation of women, it really depends at which point in American history you are. Because certainly, in 1900, cooking and cleaning were an enormous amount of work. I mean, you had to grow the food. You had to boil the water to wash the vegetables and wash the laundry and to wash the plates. Sugar at one point, you had to buy it and grind it. I mean, cooking and cleaning were full-time jobs. But that changed a lot. And by the time that much of what we think of as the things that really liberated women came along in the 50s, there's, in Laura Shapiro's book, she makes a very good case for the fact that most women didn't want it, and they had to be persuaded by the advertising community that they needed to be liberated from the kitchen. They didn't want to be liberated from the kitchen.
And in fact, Mrs. Obama is trying to take us back to the kitchen and back to the garden, back to the cleaning, I think, and back to the growing. can you talk about your feelings about the garden?
I am thrilled about the garden and thrilled that the Obamas are putting food front and center and making Americans understand that growing food is something that we should be doing, that it's a good thing. And I would think that the fact that Malia and Sasha eat vegetables is probably making children all over America stop turning their nose up at vegetables. I think it's a fabulous thing. But I do want to get back to the notion of cooking as women's work, because one of the most interesting things that's happened as I've been on tour for this book, which is granted only a week so far, but people have been buying books for their children. And what fascinates me is that when they ask me to sign them, 2-to-1, literally 2-to-1, is for guys. I mean, my son is a wonderful cook, they will say to me over and over and over again. And what's happening in this current generation is that cooking isn't women's work. for the 20-somethings. Cooking is something that guys do very happily, that's very much a communal activity that kids are doing together. And it gives me enormous hope that the person who gets the pleasure out of cooking will be the one who's cooking. And, you know, maybe it's the man, maybe it's the woman, but what's important about it is not just that you're getting this gender distinction. It's, you know, the idea of it being women's work is going away, but also the idea of pleasure is coming back in, so that cooking is not being seen as a chore. It's being seen as, you know, for me, all day long when I'm at work, one of the things that keeps me sane is knowing that at 7:30 or 7:45, I'm going to be standing in my kitchen chopping onions.
She chops her own onions.
I like to chop onions, but some people don't like to.
You know, I heard you tell someone earlier today on another show, actually with Michael Krasny on Forum. A caller called in. He asked you how he should stock his pantry. He was clearly a beginner, and how should he begin? And you said you should begin by choosing some recipes and then approach this collection slowly and carefully. And you said, discover what kind of cook you are. I think that that will be revelatory to lots of people, because it, most people sort of get it backwards. It's learn these very difficult set of techniques, and then when you do, maybe somebody eventually will sort of say, okay, you know what you're doing. But this notion of it being a journey and that there are different kinds of cooks. So how did you discover what kind of cook you were, and what kind of cook are you?
I was very lucky because I started cooking very young, because my mother was such a scary cook. I took over the cooking duties in our household at a very young age. And, you know, because nobody was telling me what to cook, I was going through cookbooks and choosing things I wanted to. So I was basically telling this guy to learn to cook the way I learned to cook, which was by picking things that sounded delicious to me and cooking them. And then, you know, you end up getting the ingredients that you like, and you learn slowly, you know, what your tastes are. And, I mean, I still have a problem because I do like my own cooking very much. So I eat much more when I'm at home than I do, for instance, when I'm in a restaurant, where I can be very restrained about what I'm eating. But, you know, when I'm cooking the food that I really feel like eating, and I tend to have seconds and thirds and fourths. I would say that what I am is I'm very much a sort of home cook. I am really not someone who thinks that you should try and replicate restaurant dishes at home. I mean, chefs do that kind of cooking, and they have a whole armies of people who do the chopping and so forth. And that's not the kind of cooking that I want to do. I make sort of very robust, full-flavored, but basically kind of simple food.
I know that MFK Fisher has been a great inspiration to you, and in fact, you met her, and you have written about that. I find one of the things about her that always strikes me is that she can be so brutally honest in her writing, as can you, by the way. But you'll be reading along, charmed by her, and suddenly you'll find yourself standing at the edge of an emotional precipice. And so I wanted to ask you actually to read a passage from a chapter. It's in the book, The Gastronomical Me, and the chapter is called The Measure of My Powers.
Oh, it's my favorite story.
1931, is it?
Yeah, I love that story. Yes.
Well, we'll see if it's the same one. And I'd like you to read it, if you would, and then comment on it.
My meals shake people from their routines, not only of meat, potatoes, gravy, but of thought, of behavior. Occasionally, I'm fond enough of a person to realize that any such spiritual upset would do more harm than good, and I bow. It is usually women past middle age who thus confound me, and I have to be very fond of them indeed. In spite of my solicitation, I still think sometimes I am betraying them and myself too. Perhaps it is not too late for them, I think. Perhaps next time they come, I will blast their safe, tidy little lives with a big tureen of hot borscht and some garlic toast and salad instead of the fruit cocktail, fish, meat, vegetable salad, dessert, and coffee they tuck daintily away 7 times a week. Perhaps they should feel the safe sand blow away so that their heads are uncovered for a time, so that they will have to taste not only the solid honesty of my red borscht, but the new flavor of the changing world. But when they come, they are so polite, so dazed, so genteelly dead already. Well, you know, this is classic Mary Frances in that, first of all, she starts with a kind of boast. My meals shake people from their routines, which is a pretty big boast. I mean, I would never have the nerve to say that my meals had shaken anyone from their routines. And I have to say that I am probably a gentler cook than that. I would not invite someone over and then deliberately serve them food that I thought they were going to loathe.
But I think that everything that you've written about suggests that food really is about life, the way we live. It's often connected so deeply to the emotions that it's even hard to extricate, to know where the food ends and the emotional life begins. And so I am curious if you can comment on what is it about certain cooking, and I'm sure that yours must be the same way, that it conveys this these different emotional states so strongly?
Well, I mean, I want to start by saying that I think that people's food choices are very deliberate, and that these women that Mary Frances is talking about here are people who really want to say to the world, I am a lady. I don't eat garlic. I don't like violent emotions, flavors, etc. And that that our food choices are intended to convey to the world who we are. I mean, I, for instance, am a person who will tell you I will try anything because that's the kind of person that I want to be. I think that one of the things that is so interesting about the world that we've created now is that we really have created, I mean, these women that she's talking about, there aren't a lot of them left anymore. And those that are left tend to be older people. But that younger people tend to have, you know, very adventurous palates today, and that people are much more open to food. And that's very much, I don't think it's attributable to anything that any one person did, but that it has a lot to do with immigration patterns in the country. And, you know, I think one of the things that has really changed the way that we eat is that when people used to come to America, they knew that they were coming here forever. When they passed Ellis Island or Angel Island, they knew that they were anchored in this land and that they weren't going home. And people who come today have a real sense that they're certainly going to be able to visit their homes and that they may actually go home again. And so they don't try and assimilate in the same way. And in old days, people gave up their food ways really quickly. And, in the 50s, you know, if you opened up a kid's lunchbox, everybody would have, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and tuna salad sandwiches or maybe bologna. But today, people cling to their food ways very fiercely. It's something that they're proud of and they want their children to know. And so when you open up lunchboxes today, what you find are, you know, kimchi and tacos and just rice balls and people saying, you know, this is who I am. And I think that's what's changed the way that we eat, is that we experience each other's cooking.
And you've also pointed out that there's so much more experimentation now on everybody's part, and so there's a kind of a wonderful sort of culinary meld that's constantly going on. And I want to ask you about that, but before I do, I just want to remind everyone that we're here at the Commonwealth Club with Ruth Reichel. And I want to mention that in the October issue of Gourmet, you have this feature. It's called Having a Grand Time. And in this feature, you give several food critics, yourself included, a hypothetical $1,000 to blow on some great meals. Now, you went on your fantasy dining outing, and you spent $700 of your $1,000. It's very brazen.
Well, it was fantasy, right? I thought I would never spend it if I had it.
Well, this is partly my question. You spent $700 on the tasting menu for two at Per Se,
right.
Thomas Keller's, of course, your restaurant in Columbus Circle. So I would imagine that, you know, the food police bloggers have already issued an APB for you just for even suggesting that you would do such a thing. But I guess I'm wondering, how do you respond to the folks who feel that that kind of excess is just too excessive?
You know, I truly believe that great restaurants are a kind of memorable theater, and that if you go to the right restaurant, what you're buying is a memory for the rest of your life. And that if... And, you know, I mean, it's so funny that people get upset about this kind of excess, but they don't about somebody going out and spending, you know, $3,000 on a pocketbook, or you know, a luxury car, and you know, I believe that these kinds of, you know, really transporting moments in restaurants are really worthwhile to us. That they take us to some place that we don't normally get to go, and for me, it's like sailing away. It's a vacation, and I don't want it to happen that often, but I want it to happen every once in a while as a special treat.
Well, you also, on this fantasy adventure, you also went downtown to David Chang's Momofuku, and you describe one of the dishes that you ordered, which is certainly, I would say, rather out of the ordinary. Sea urchin in whipped tofu with scallions and beet-infused tapioca. Now, I have to say, this sounds like a borderline comedy sketch to me. I mean, in fact, it sort of reminds me of this little game that you can play on a site that I like a lot called Zucchini and Chocolate. There's a Parisian woman named Clotilde Dussolier. I'm sure some people are familiar with her. She has a following that's not unlike Julie Powell's on her blog, and it's ardent enthusiasm. Anyway, you can hit this button called Plat du Jour, and you can get a random computer-generated grouping of ingredients. And so I went and did this recently, and here's what I got. Moroccan ricotta salad and buttermilk cashews. But then I hit the button again, and I got citrus catfish orecchiette with poached garlic. So I take it that neither of those two really
They don't do it for you. They didn't do much for me, no.
Well, my question is, with this melding and this keeping of one's own culinary traditions, I guess what you're saying is that the melting pot isn't melting so much anymore. But clearly people are being influenced by so many different culinary traditions. Is there some outer limit to ingredient cohabitation?
Probably not. I have to say that if you suspend disbelief, this whipped tofu with these beet-infused tapioca and the sea urchin is one of the most delicious things that I've ever had in my life. The flavors work gorgeously, and the textures, I mean, what you're looking at is a whole different range of soft textures. And it is a memorably delicious dish, and something I can't get often enough. But what you need is, you know, someone, I mean, I think David is a kind of food genius, and there are people like that who are able to combine ingredients in really extraordinary ways. And You know, one of the things that's so exciting about all of these amazing ingredients, which are suddenly available to all of us, is that we get to think about putting them together in ways that nobody else has ever thought of.
Well, I think I heard that on this visit you've been to Qua.
I was at Qua, yes.
Okay, so you're a San Francisco critic and having a grand time. Patricia Unterman, whom locals will recognize as the doyenne of the Hay Street Grill, and of course a writer herself, she chose Qua for her imaginary outing. And she described an 11-course meal that includes wild leaves. I'm not sure what the domesticated ones look like. Seaweed, coastal grasses, and heirloom flora and fauna. All handpicked by Chef Daniel Patterson, who says that foraging and cooking are for him one single activity. Now, I would contend that a meal such as this is a breed apart.
It is a breed apart. You know, again, this is a chef who is very talented, who is thinking out of the box, and the reason you go there is to have him serve you things that you never imagined before and have them work. I had a soup there that was just so lovely that was made of piquillo peppers, and it was very clean with just some beans in it. And, you know, it all felt like it had been picked like an hour earlier. It couldn't have been less contrived, but it was magic in the mouth.
So let's talk, let's go back to the book for a moment, because let's hope that we have some things in the book that will create magic in the mouth also. I'm just wondering, what are the dishes that you think are really exceptional in the book, or is the book really trying to be a sort of everyday kind of pleasurable but not knock your socks off experience?
Oh, no. There are, you know, dozens and dozens of knock your socks off experiences in here from, you know, many of them are very simple. I mean, there's a pork shoulder that's marinated in garlic for 13 hours and then just put into the oven so that the outside gets incredibly crispy. So you have sort of like chicharrón on the outside with the pork. And it's something that you couldn't have done 5 years ago before heritage pork was widely available, because it requires the meat to actually have some flavor. But what you get is just... well, I mean, it's true. You need some fat in that meat. And but what you end up with is something that just sings the flavor of that animal and is incredibly delicious.
You've said you can't be a good cook if you don't have a generous soul and the impulse to take care of people.
I absolutely believe that.
I think it's a really wonderful, wonderful statement. You also mentioned, you go on to say, I only know two good cooks who are stingy in their souls. I'm not sure if you'd like to tell us who they are.
Actually, one of them is no longer alive. No, I don't want it. On national radio, I'm going to say, here are two really stingy souls. I don't think so.
That was actually just sort of a brief pause. Really, what I wanted to say to you is, can you learn to be a generous soul? A few minutes ago, you were talking about the pleasure of cooking and how many young men particularly are learning that it's not a chore, it's a pleasure. With this book and with some help and the technique and understanding the vegetables, can you learn to have that generosity of cooking? I guess what I'm really saying is, do you have to be born a great cook, or can you actually learn how to be one?
I think you can learn how to be one. And I think, you know, one of the reasons I got into the food world in the first place was because I loved these people so much. I mean, I met all of these cooks who impressed me with their largeness of spirit. And I thought, these are people I want to be around. And I think that through cooking, you can learn to sort of shed your constraints. I mean, I think that one of the things you learn from cooking is more is better, that you learn to relax, you learn to trust yourself, And as you start making food that people like, you learn to need, you crave that kind of joy that you give people. It is such an easy pleasure. There is nothing quite like putting food that you've made in front of people and watching them just glow because it tastes so good. And
I'm coming to dinner.
It's addictive. I think cooking is addictive. I mean, once you really start finding your chops as a cook, you want to keep doing it. So I absolutely think you can learn, and that part of what you learn is generosity.
I want to ask you some questions that came up from the audience. One of them is, I'm sure, a question that so many people across the country have. What do you suggest to people who feel that they don't have time to cook healthy meals these days?
Well, I have two suggestions. And one is, you know, we make time for anything we think is important. And I just don't buy that.
Okay.
And second, that's one. But secondly, you know, a big part of what this book is about is cooking is not the time-consuming part. Shopping is.
Mm-hmm.
It's figuring out what you're going to cook. That is, you know, it's if it's suddenly like 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you're going, oh my God, what am I going to cook for dinner? You've already lost the battle. And I would say, you know, take an hour every weekend and figure out what you're going to cook that week and get the ingredients in the house. Then you go home and getting dinner on the table is 20 minutes.
Someone else asked that your son seems to be an adventurous and healthy eater. Are there any secrets to success that you can share with us?
Well, the introduction to this book, which I'm sorry to say I think embarrasses Nick, talks about the fact that when he was very young, he ate 5 white foods. And everybody thought that it was hilarious that, you know, I was a restaurant critic of the LA Times at that point, and I had this kid who literally ate 5 white foods, and if he picked up a new one, he dropped an old one. So, and this went on and on, and I mean, this is a child who had never eaten a vegetable, and I was really worried about it, and I talked to the doctor, and she said, you know, Ruth, no sane child starves himself. Don't worry about it. He's fine. Just don't worry. It's very hard not to worry when your kid is turning his nose up at almost everything. But I decided that we had two choices. We could make every meal a struggle. It could be a battle. Or we could just say, you know, we're going to all eat dinner, and he could watch us eat with great pleasure, and I would give him 3 or 4 of his 5 white foods. And that at some point, he would learn that food was pleasurable. And sure enough, around the age of 9, food kicked in for him. And he
got up one morning and said, Mom, I want kohlrabi.
Yeah, actually, one morning he got up and said, you know I love Brussels sprouts. And I thought, where did that come from?
Here's another one. Do you miss your days as a food critic?
Not at all.
I think, if I'm correct, the first job that you went out on was in San Francisco. You went to Le Trianon, which was the restaurant that was owned by René Vaudan, and he was the Kennedy's chef in the White House, of course, and then he came out and opened his own restaurant here. Can you briefly just recount the tale of that first foray?
Well, actually, it was not a Trianon. It was a restaurant called Robert, which was in the Marina. And so, you know, I'm living in essentially this commune in Berkeley, and I've gotten the first moment when we can, you know, I'm going to take all of us out. We all went to Value Village to buy clothes, appropriate clothes to go out. And my husband at the time had turned his van into a camera obscura. So we all lay down in the bed. He had mattresses on the bottom, and so we all, you know, lay down and watched the world go by upside down as we went up. And of course, we couldn't give the car to a valet, so we all get out. We find a place to park, and we all get out, sort of like clowns getting out of a vehicle. More of us keep coming, and we go into this very fancy restaurant.
And was it Verdon's restaurant?
It wasn't Verdon's restaurant. Oh, okay. It was another fancy French restaurant.
Okay.
And what happened was all my friends really wanted me to have this job because we were all going to get free meals, and it was very exciting. So they all decided to help me. And so, you know, one of them is, you know, noticing the waiter, and he's paying attention to every move that the waiter makes. And one of my roommates, Sherry, who is now also a restaurant critic, you know, is tasting and going, I think there's oregano in here and bay leaves. And the guy who had been the bartender is paying attention. And I just had this little moment when I had an epiphany that I saw us as a gang who had been sent by a rival restaurateur to find fault with this restaurant. And I thought this was such a brilliant idea that I ran home and I wrote the review, a kind of short story, a film noir story that began, "The names have all been changed to protect the innocent." And I wrote this, and I called it Cops and Robert. And
that's a good one.
For the next, you know, 6 years in at New West Magazine, I wrote short stories that were
and headlines.
Yes.
Here's a question that I think also everybody wants to know. Presumably, you saw the movie Julie and Julia.
I haven't seen it.
Ah, okay. Well, then we can't ask you what you think of it.
But I can
ask you what you think of the premise.
Well, I can tell you that at Gourmet.com, Laura Shapiro, who was the biographer, the posthumous biographer of Julia Child, has written a very pointed review that has, when I looked last, which was yesterday, I think it had 103 comments. So she feels very strongly that the Julia part of it is fabulous, and the Julie part of it is not so fabulous.
And I think she also points out that Julia Child, who was aware of the blog, although she died in, 1994, and the book was published in 1995, I believe. So she wasn't alive to see the book, but she was aware of the blog, and she didn't like the blog. And she said that she didn't think that Julie Powell could cook.
Right, and it's interesting because I saw Chuck Williams the other day, and I asked him what he thought, and he said, you know, what the movie doesn't get is Julia did her homework. She did it. She was a really hard worker, and it took her a long time to learn to cook, and she did not have respect for people who tried to take shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of her problem.
Will we ever see you as a judge on Top Chef?
Well, it's very interesting because they asked me to be a judge for Top Chef Masters this summer. And I couldn't sign the contract. It allowed them to basically put me in shows that I wasn't in, and in a word, no.
But you've just completed, actually, for PBS, I believe it's a 10-segment series, and it's called Gourmet's Adventures with Ruth, right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that.
We did an issue about cooking schools around the world a couple of years ago, and my producer at WGBH said this would be a fabulous television show. And so I went to cooking schools all over the world in Brazil and China and Venice and Bath and Morocco and Laos. I mean, literally around the world, with various friends in tow. Francis McDormand came to one cooking school with me, and Jeffrey Wright came to one, and Diane Wiest came to a couple, and Tom Skerritt came, and Lauren Bracco, and a few other people, and we took these classes together, and we not only learned, we all learned so much. I mean, it was just wonderful. We also got really immersed in the life of that country. We went to markets, we gardened, we went to farms, we went to dairies, we made cheese. You know, cooking schools are a real way to discover a country, not as an alien visitor, but as sort of part of the country. And it was the most wonderful summer I've ever had. I was so glad that I hadn't done the Top Chef thing, because I couldn't have done both.
And when will that air?
It starts on PBS October 18th, and there are 10 episodes.
And you're not wearing disguises?
I'm not wearing disguises. It's very gritty. I mean, it's like it was very hot in some of these places, and you know, it was 126 degrees in Morocco, and we were cooking over open fires. So the idea of like trying to wear a disguise or even makeup in that was almost impossible.
Well, here's someone who clearly was very enraptured by the idea that you wore all these different disguises when you were, of course, the food critic for the New York Times. The question is, in which disguise did you receive the best service, and in which the worst service?
Oh, that's easy. Without any question, the best service was as Chloe, the blonde bombshell. Well, I really learned that blondes have more fun. I mean, and the worst service was Betty, who was my sort of very pathetic old lady. And nobody wanted Betty to anywhere in sight. They buried Betty in, you know, the back of every restaurant if they couldn't get rid of her, and they tried hard to get rid of her.
And did that influence the review that then you wrote?
Yes, but I went to every restaurant both in disguise and out of disguise. I mean, I there was no restaurant that I didn't go to as myself as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure anybody knew that. So what was the idea of that?
Well, I mean, I thought it was a kind of fairness
to let them just go crazy and agonize all over you and make sure you had best meal on
Earth. Just to see what other critics were experiencing, you know, and to see how big the difference was. And, you know, the places where there was no difference were the ones who got the really stellar reviews.
And there were places where there was no difference.
Oh, there were absolutely.
Raisha walked in the door.
There were absolutely places where there was no difference.
Hmm. I think great culinary memories can come in strange packages. There's quite a few questions about one of yours. I remember from Fisher, or Mary Frances, as you call her. I don't know that I could do that. She said that she would always remember the first potato chips that she ever tasted in Europe because they were fried in butter and then salted. And she said, it seems impossible, but the fact remains that it was one of the keenest gastronomic moments of my life. And I'm wondering, and so are many people, what is a food memory for you that is absolutely outstanding, that really rises above the rest?
It was when we were in Crete and we walked up this mountain, and there was a pile of onions. The government had told people to grow onions, and this woman had this pile of onions sitting next to her little cabin there. And when we got there, she put out olive oil that she had pressed herself and put herbs that she'd gathered on the hillside and gave us some wine that her neighbor was making and a loaf of bread that she had baked, and then she went down fishing. And she came back up and grilled this fish over a fire. And it was the moment where I had this epiphany about the right food in the right place.
And it, when was this?
This was in 1970. It was on my first honeymoon. And it was a meal, you know, for me it was that the whole idea of local, seasonal, this food right here, and we waited a long time for her to catch the fish and cook the fish. And, you know, we were sitting there and the sun was going down, and it was this very beautiful place. And I suddenly realized that this food just tasted better to me than anything I'd ever eaten before.
Mm-hmm. I think lots of people are fascinated by disasters in kitchens. They seem to be a kind of a thread that, you know, runs through so many stories. So I'm going to ask you to tell us a story about a disaster, and I'm going to give you a little on-ramp, as it were. I'm going to read you something that James Beard wrote. He was in Paris living there, and a French friend took him to a small bistro that he was told was famous for its simple but excellent cookery. So you can think about this while you think about yours. And he wrote afterward, "The dinner was an absolute fiasco from start to finish. Our host failed to arrive. The chef was absent because he was suffering from influenza. The waiter was depressed because he had just returned from the funeral of his mother. The lobsters were overcooked. The soup had gone sour and the lettuce was limp. The steaks were tough. The sauce had curdled and the sorbet had melted. The red wine was too cold and the white wine was too warm. No meal could have been worse. The evening ended marvelously, however, for precisely at 11 p.m., a fire started in the kitchen. And by midnight, the place had burned to the ground." Actually, knowing how extraordinarily well-traveled you are, I should ask you, were you there that night?
No. My most similar experience to that has quite a different ending, but when I was reviewing restaurants for New Weston, we went to a place out in the sunset, and there was some kind of dramatic histrionics where there was a woman cooking in the kitchen, and a man came in with a knife going after her. And the restaurant sort of gradually cleared out. You could hear all the shouting, and the restaurant cleared out. And at a certain point, we were the only people left in the restaurant. And the owner came and put our food down and said, "You know, please enjoy yourselves. I'll be right back." And he left, and the evening stretches on, and we finish our food, and an hour goes by, and an hour, and we're looking at each other and going, "Can we just walk out and leave this place unlocked?"
And did we do the dishes?
And we went into the kitchen, and you know, we counted the money in the drawer, and there wasn't very much. And then we thought, we can't just leave, so we did the dishes, and then we, you know, poured ourselves some more wine, and we sat down and waited for the owner to come back. And the owner came back, and without blinking, he gave us the check. We paid the check and left. And so I wrote this entire thing in the review, and they then started doing ads that said, "Where the customer does the dishes."
Lots of people seem interested in your thoughts on movements like eating raw food and macrobiotic eating.
Well, I have to say that when I was in college, I had a macrobiotic boyfriend who actually moved into the, I guess it was a commune or something in Boston where Osawa was actually living. And I went to visit him, and we sat down for these long dinners where you had to chew every bite 50 times, and Osawa came by and looked at me and said, very in, eat less sugar. And I was appalled by the food. It was so undelicious to me. It cured me forever of those kind of very extreme food movements. These people just all seemed have so little joy in life that I turned my back on it forever.
Let's see. So we know that Nick was not always interested in risotto, but there's lots of people who are asking here, what do you do if a kid doesn't really come around by age 9? What would you suggest when people begin to lose hope around the beginning of the teenage years?
Leave them alone. I mean, you don't want food to be a torture. You really don't. You don't ever want your children to think of the table as that place where only horrible things ever happened. I am convinced that people find their own appetite eventually, mm-hmm. and you have to let them do it.
Well, let me jump back to romance.
Okay. I'm all for romance.
That's always more interesting than children that won't eat. So Coleman Andrews, who featured quite prominently in your second book, Comfort Me with Apples, he was your boss in one of your first magazine jobs, and he was also your lover. And then he went on to become the co-founder and the editor-in-chief of Savoir magazine. But then 3 years ago, he came to work for you at Gourmet. So what is it like to have those tables turned?
Well, it's kind of great. I mean, I am one of those people who believes in that if the people that you have loved, there was a reason why you loved people, and it would be a shame to lose them in your life. And Coleman and I have actually been working for each other on and off for most of our careers. I mean, I started working for him. Then when I was the food editor of the LA Times, he worked for me. So, and then when he first went to Savoir, I worked for him. So we've been sort of...
So soon you'll be working for him again.
Without any doubt. Without any doubt. And, you know, we have... I think we have great respect for each other, and we've learned a lot from each other, and he is one really fun guy to eat with.
When you walk into a restaurant, is there something that you can see from the outset that the rest of us probably would miss that will indicate to you what the quality of the food is likely to be?
I don't know that it's something that other people aren't aware of, but... smell is very important to me, and the first thing that happens to me when I walk into a restaurant, I mean, I can smell whether it's going to be good or not, and half the time you get that odor up off the carpet, and you think you can smell all the accumulated food smells of many years in here, and I just don't want to be here. The other thing that sort of stuns me about restaurants is how little attention they pay to the quality of the bread and butter. It's the first thing that you eat. And often you're there eating it for a long time before your food shows up. And the idea, you know, half the time they'll bring out butter that's been sitting uncovered in the refrigerator and it tastes like the icebox, and you just, or in the bread, as they've tried to save money on the bread. And if I had a restaurant, I would bake my own bread, churn my own butter, but I would make sure that those first bites were the best thing that my customers had ever eaten.
Well, I know that you were once, you didn't own a restaurant, but you were the co-owner of a communal restaurant, The Swallow in Berkeley.
Right. And we baked our own bread.
And churned your own butter?
We did not churn our own butter. But if we had that restaurant today, we would be churning our own butter.
Would you ever have a restaurant again?
Oh, my God, no. I mean, once you have been a restaurant critic, you are a target for everybody that you were ever mean to. No way would
There's
I do
There's no disguise good enough.
No.
You look a little worried.
I would be. I mean, I think there would be a lot of people come gunning for me.
But mentioning no names.
No.
Well, coming back to this book, I guess one question that I must ask you is it disaster-proof?
I think it is disaster-proof. I mean, our testing process at Gourmet is kind of silly, I think. When I got there, I really thought, I mean, these people are out of their minds. They test and test and test. When I was in, I was doing a thing in New York, and one of our test cooks came to do a demo while I was talking. And I said, okay, you know, Ian, what's the simplest recipe in the book? And he said, it's got to be that spaghetti cacio e pepe, which is literally four ingredients. And I said, how many times did we test the recipe for the book? He said, 12. Wow. And I mean, it's got four ingredients. And I said, why did we test it 12 times? And he said, because we wanted to get the proportions exactly right. We wanted to make sure that this was the best version of this dish that anyone was ever going to make. And we do that with every recipe. It just gets tested again and again and again and again. And when it's finally done, it gets cross-tested by another cook.
Wow. That's scary to me to even pick up the book that's been through all of that.
No, it's not scary. The idea is that we so you
so
only have
to.
good results.
Well, we're down, unfortunately, to our last question, and it's going to be mine. I have that prerogative. I want to ask you, what's a wonderful meal that your son has made for you?
Oh, that's such a nice question.
I assume he has made a meal for you.
He has made a meal for me, and it was so sweet. It was when I was coming back from one of these trips, and you know, I mean, like coming back from Laos, it's 28 hours to come back, and he said, you know, Mom, you know, what would you like me to cook when you get home? I'll make anything you want. And I said, you know, I would really, it was the height of summer. And I said, you know, all I really want is some spaghetti with a really good tomato sauce on it and a little salad. And he said, you got it. And I got off the plane, and there it was.
Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed tonight's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Ruth Reichel, Editor-in-Chief, Gourmet Magazine, and Editor of Gourmet Today, and Katrina Hiran, Director of the Chez Panisse Foundation, our audience in here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.